For her work with sustainable development, Newsweek named Hunter Lovins a green business icon. Time magazine calls her a millennium hero of the planet. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hunter Lovins is coming to Iowa this week. She says it's possible to improve our economy and take on climate change at the same time with something called climate capitalism. And we'll talk with Lovins in the first half hour. Then science guy Bill Nye joins us. He'll tell us about a controversial video he made warning schools and parents not to teach kids creationism as science. Nye will speak at Iowa State University later this week. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news.
Don't emit carbon and air pollutants that are poisoning us as a species. Iowa had a very healthy wind energy industry, and it's now threatened. Iowa is losing jobs. Clipper Wind Power recently laid off 174 employees, reducing its workforce by a third because of fear of losing this tax credit. At the same time, every effort in Congress to overturn the subsidies to the oil industry, the so-called free marketeers in the Tea Party, want to keep giving your and my tax dollars to the oil industry, which, as I mentioned, is the most profitable ever in human history.
Hunter Lovins, before our time gets away, I'd like to play a little clip from the recent GOP convention when Mitt Romney spoke, because it gets to some of the points that you're making. I'd like to play this clip and get your reaction. I'm sure you heard it. Let's just listen in, and listen in to not only what Governor Romney says, but to the reaction of the GOP delegates.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans. And to heal the planet. My promise is to help you and your family.
Mitt Romney, days ago at the GOP convention. What does that tell you, Hunter Lovins, about awareness in this country, about what you're talking about, and the political debate on it in this country?
The political debate has been poisoned by organizations funded by David and Charles Koch, owners of Valero and Tesoro Oil, who have been funding organizations like the Heartland Institute to go around to every chamber of commerce in the country. And I've sat in meetings with these folks. The guy from Heartland says climate change is a hoax. And a guy from Peabody Coal says, oh, we can do clean coal. And a guy from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says, doing anything, taking any action to limit climate change would bankrupt the economy. They're lying. They're just flat lying. However, they have more money than folk like me. And they've done a better job of getting their message out. Surprise, the American people keep hearing over and over and over again, ah, climate change is a hoax. So I said, fine, it's a hoax. Let's look at business. So we work with small businesses, and I've done a fair amount of work in Iowa with little businesses, showing them using a web-based learning tool we have called Solutions at the Speed of Business, how to implement more sustainable practices in their companies, cutting their costs, better differentiating their product, inspiring their workforce, and driving their profitability. For example, we worked with a little company out in California called Mi Rancho Tortillas. They make tortillas. Their COO, Joe Santana, had no earthly interest in sustainability, but he wanted to sell to Walmart. Walmart, as you may have heard, is now putting key performance indicators on its buyers to buy products from companies that are behaving more sustainably. Joe said, what do I have to do? We helped him do a lighting retrofit. We helped him get more efficient ovens. We helped him eliminate waste packaging, something Walmart's big on because they don't want to pay to haul it away after they've paid to haul it to them. he's going to save $450,000 over the next couple of years. You better believe he's now a big fan of sustainability.
Mm-hmm. For companies, business leaders listening to this program, how do they find out more about Natural Capitalism Solutions, Hunter?
We have a website, www.natcapsolutions.org, as in Natural Capitalism Solutions. They can Google Natural Capitalism Solutions, and they'll get to our website. They can come to my talks in Iowa. I'll be happy to sit down with any business leaders and explain to them why this is just better business for them and how they can access this web-based learning tool so that they can implement sustainability for themselves affordably on their own time.
I wonder if you can point to any other country in the world outside of our borders where you can point to as a good model for us, at least in some sense, that the path we should be taking.
Sure. Germany reckons to be 100% renewable by 2050, 2060. Siemens, the big German industrial conglomerate, has said, we're getting out of coal and nuclear. That's not a good business.
But
they're investing in renewables.
Right. But we know Germany is not very good at business, right?
Right. And indeed, what Germany did was put in place a good policy called a feed-in tariff. They pay a fair price for any green electron. And as a result, why is it that California gets 70% more sun than cold, cloudy Germany? But Germany last year installed 28 times as much solar as in California because solar entrepreneurs get paid for it. Oh, but you say, if you pay more, it's going to raise our rates. Deutsche Bank did a study. Yep, rates will go up 2 to 3 euro a month, $50 a year. In total, something like 8.6 billion euros. Sounds like a lot of money. What Deutsche Bank pointed out was, had they done nothing, had they just kept burning coal, their rates would have gone up 9.4 billion euro. So investing now in energy efficiency, in renewable energy, is the best way to cut your cost. The town of Wilspolsried in Germany is not only 100% renewably powered, they export their excess, earning themselves $5 million a year. Would you like your town to get $5 million a year?
Hunter Lovins, we have just about 3 minutes left. Tell us, what is the path from where we are now, today, to where we need to be, in your estimation?
The path forward, and this is why I wrote the book, The Way Out, Kickstarting Capitalism to Save Our Economic Ass, is to invest in the technologies that bring us the jobs, the security, the prosperity in our own communities. These are overwhelmingly energy efficiency, renewable energy, sustainable agriculture. They're the whole array of the green economy, which is now growing three times as fast as the traditional economy. A quarter of the jobs in the green economy are manufacturing jobs. Do we want to bring manufacturing back to the United States? We know how to. Demand of your politicians that they understand what it is that will bring prosperity to your community, to your state, to our country, and then vote. This election really matters. Please vote.
And finally, I see that you served as an advisor to the energy minister of the government of Afghanistan. Tell us how that came about and what that was about.
When I was in Afghanistan doing economic development work, working with USAID and others with the UN and various aid agencies, a man named Ismail Khan was named as the energy minister. He's known in this country as the Butcher of Herat. A lot of people were very dismayed. But I said, well, I guess I need to talk to the old boy. So through some Afghan friends, they got me a meeting. They said, you have 5 minutes. Searched at gunpoint. Ushered into this room, and my first thought looking at him was, he has kind eyes. He looked like a kindly professor.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of about 30 seconds left.
Mm-hmm. My interpreter said, you have 5 minutes. I said to him, you have the opportunity to transform your economy. You're going to build everything from scratch. Can I show you what the best companies and communities are doing? So we sat and looked at the sorts of examples I have in the book. Afterwards, he said, would you advise my ministry? I said, I would be honored. But you have to tell me if what I say makes sense to you, because there are many, many ways forward. I'm not selling anything. I'm here to serve you. He said that is the only basis for a friendship.
Hunter Lovins,
we'll
leave it there. Interesting, fascinating story. Hunter Lovins, a leader in sustainable management. You will be speaking three times in Iowa on October 3rd and 4th. You'll be at Iowa State University on October 3rd, in Des Moines on October 4th, also in Iowa City on October 4th. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me with you.
Coming up in just a moment, the science guy, Bill Nye, joins us to tell us about a controversial video he made warning schools and parents not to teach kids creationism as science. When we return after this short break, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Bill Nye. Yes, the one and only Bill Nye, the science guy. Currently, he's the host of three TV series, The 100 Greatest Discoveries, which airs on the Science Channel, The Eyes of Nye on PBS stations, and Nye's latest project, hosting a show on Planet Green called Stuff Happens. Bill Nye will be appearing at Iowa State University this Friday at 7 p.m. in Stevens Auditorium. His talk, You Can Change the World. It's part of Iowa State's Engineers Week 2012. Bill Nye, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to mention that the bio on your website lists this as your mission. You help foster a scientifically literate society, help people everywhere understand and appreciate the science that makes our world work. And we've seen that in recent days, that this is not a mission free from controversy, especially when you know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah.
Most recently, you've been receiving attention for a YouTube video, which you say... you say that creationism should not be taught in schools, and you make a direct plea to parents not to teach creationism to their children. Let's listen to a little bit.
And I say to the grown-ups, if you want to deny evolution and live in your world that's completely inconsistent with everything we observe in the universe, that's fine. But don't make your kids do it, because we need them. We need scientifically literate voters and taxpayers for the future. We need people that can, we need engineers that can build stuff, solve problems.
Bill Nye, what were you trying to do with that video?
So let's keep in mind, when you listen to that clip, in general, the context is not that creation shouldn't be taught in school in general. I think it's of great historical interest. But tax dollars intended for teaching science should not be used to teach creationism as an alternative to the provable facts. The claim that the Earth is 6,000 years old or 10,000 years old is wrong, is incorrect. It is, arguing by analogy is weak, but it would be like trying to teach that the world is flat. It's just not right. It's wrong. So it is not appropriate to use tax dollars for that in science class. If people want to teach it in philosophy class or history of religion or history of science, I can understand it, but it is not. It's not right. It's wrong. The facts are wrong.
You go beyond that. You go beyond the schools. You go into the home and make a plea to parents, though, and say, "Do not do this with your children. It's okay if you believe it. Don't do it to the children of this country."
Well, that would be great. That this is you can't tell people what to do, but it's for voters and taxpayers. In other words, if you're in a school district where you have a school board that's insisting on this, the argument was called by Judge John E. Jones in Dover, Pennsylvania, breathtaking inanity. This is to say, if you want to do something so silly it takes this guy's breath away, it's important to not have children in your school district raised with that idea. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit out of context, but just a little bit. Mm-hmm. This is to say it's about tax dollars for science education.
Tell me what's behind the chuckle when I mentioned that this is not free from controversy. You've had some colorful reactions. I'm sure you've had a lot of support for that message. But
could you
describe some of the harsher or, shall we say, colorful reactions you've had?
Well, people just hate me. I mean, but I say all the time, whether or not I'm here, the Earth is not 6 or 10,000 years old. It's just not. You know, shooting the messenger, or let's be nice about it, imprisoning the messenger, or silencing the messenger, isn't going to make the Earth 6,000 years old. So, fine.
It sounds like you were caught off guard by the reaction.
Well, here's what it was. I did that video. I thought at first I may have done it in June, but looking back, I think it might have been long before that, and it languished for months. And then here in August, it caught on. I guess it went viral, as the saying goes. And this is mathematics, by the way, exponential growth.
Mm-hmm. Do you know yet what the end of that story is with this video?
No. I hope the end's not over. I mean, if people in the scientifically literate world were able to eventually raise a generation of people who did not embrace this breathtakingly inane idea, it would be to the good. But how long did it take people to let go of the Earth is flat? I don't think it was a weekend. I think it was, you know, centuries. So, but here's my further argument that's very important to me. If we allow a generation of students to be raised with this as an alternative, or let's put it this way, to be influenced with the idea that the Earth is 6,000 years old as a possibility, that will hold the U.S. economy back. This is my claim, that it will make us less technologically sophisticated, less technologically able. We will raise fewer competent scientists and engineers. We'll raise fewer competent anythings, because this idea is just wrong and silly and an improper use of science education dollars. And so we will end up getting beaten economically by other economies, other countries that embrace the scientific method and the way we know the universe and, if you will, the truth about the age of the Earth. And so everybody this campaign season is talking about jobs, 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 jobs. I claim, and I don't think it's an extraordinary claim, that if you raise a generation of students who are scientifically illiterate, you are going to hold the U.S. back at the thing that it's good at, which is technological leadership. We are not especially good at manufacturing Olympic uniforms, for example. We're not especially good at making souvenir coffee cups. But nobody else, so far, invents something akin to the iPhone. Nobody else is able to land spacecraft on the surface of Mars. But when you do that sort of thing, you raise the expectations of your society. You raise what people believe they can accomplish, and then they accomplish more. So for me, this creationism thing is, to bear in mind, to people in the scientific literate world, this creationism thing is just silly and inane and hard to believe it's even happening. But in the bigger picture, I claim that we will lose jobs because of this.
In what way can science, though, science and faith coexist?
Well, faith is one thing. I have no problem with faith.
Religion.
Religion's fine. It's the claim that the Earth is 6,000 years old. It's just wrong. The claim that humans and the ancient dinosaurs lived at the same time is just wrong. It's not. If your religion insists on that, and you want to use something in the U.S. Constitution to insist on that, I strongly encourage you to step back and understand why you believe that.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Bill Nye, and he'll be speaking at Iowa State University later this week on Friday, and that's at 7 p.m. in Stevens Auditorium. His talk, You Can Change the World. More broadly speaking, you just mentioned how scientific literacy can translate into economic prosperity, into jobs. Do you feel like scientific literacy has faltered in this country?
Well, there's been a lot of concern about scientific integrity. The Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Virginia trying to sue Michael Mann, who discovered one of the discoverers of climate change, is an attack on science. That's only for example. This attack on science and this insistence that science is one more special interest is, I think, misguided and not in anyone's best interest.
Why do you think the attack has risen? Why is it more intense?
Well, books are written, but it has become, ironically, politicized. You know, very conservative people designed the weapons that won wars. Very conservative people are designing engineering things for the sake of very conservative causes. Yet we have a situation right now where it apparently, if you're conservative, well, boy, I don't want to say something's going to be misquoted, but there's a current tradition with conservatives to dismiss or decrease the importance of scientific inquiry. And so the guy running for president right now got a laugh talking about climate change. He dismissed it as though it was an invalid idea, that his opponent was going to slow the level of the sea the ocean level rising. Is that a bad thing? You don't want to slow the level of the oceans rising? You're okay with the world getting warmer? That's okay with you? And so
you're saying this is a case where politics is winning, you said.
Or it's being sold to a huge block of voters as a reason to vote for that side, that they dismiss science. That's like a good thing.
What should be done against that?
Well, I tell everybody, vote. I mean, that if you have a candidate running for anything who dismisses science and doesn't see the economic value of scientific inquiry, I would not vote for that person. I mean, that's your power as a voter.
Bill Nye, your website also says that anyone you've talked to who's involved with science as an adult fell in love with science or became fascinated with it before the age of 10. What do you think is so critical about that age?
Oh, well, that was based on research. So the age of 10 was chosen for the design of the Science Guy show because we had some very compelling research back in the 1990s that 10 is about as old as you can be to get what was called in this one thing, the lifelong passion for science. And I would say anecdotally myself, it's probably as old as you can get to get the lifelong passion for anything. Like ask your accountant, when did he want to account? And they love numbers. Accountants love numbers before they were 10. Ask anybody who's an English major, they love stories and language before they're 10 years old, generally. Now, if it's not 10, it's 11 or 12, but it's not 17. By the time someone's 16, 18 years old, he or she it's hard to influence them to become full-time scientists and engineers. And since then, I've come across some other researchers very compelling and a real opportunity for us, I think, as U.S. voters and taxpayers. Algebra is the single most reliable indicator of whether or not a person pursues a career in engineering or science.
What about algebra?
That if you don't embrace algebra or get good at it as, let's say, a tween between 10 years old and 16 years old, you will have trouble, apparently, or be reluctant to think abstractly about all sorts of things. And so here's my claim, that algebra is inexpensive to teach. We don't need to throw huge amounts of money at the problem to teach algebra. What I think, based on the research I've done so far, and I may be influenced by more research, but what we would do is start teaching the idea that symbols can represent numbers just earlier in school, just emphasize it more in fifth, sixth grade in the U.S., in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, so that by the time you really have to buckle down and do those word problems that people make fun of, you'll be just a little more comfortable with it. And then we could raise a generation of people that can think or is more inclined to think abstractly about these other things because they're more comfortable with algebra. Whether or not they pursue a career in math or science, they're just more comfortable with this abstract thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's a suggestion for improvement in our schools. Do you see any things in schools that especially worry you now?
Well, right now, let's tell you, this seems like a solvable problem. Okay, No Child Left Behind seemed like a reasonable idea. You have national standards people have to meet, and you tie that to teacher performance. You tie teacher performance to student success, to teacher performance, to No Child Left Behind, to minimum national standards. It all seemed cool idea, great. I have not met dozens of science teachers. I have not met hundreds. I have met tens of thousands of science teachers, and nobody likes it. So there's something wrong. There's something fixable wrong.
Do you know what it is?
Well, I just think science has to be part of the core curriculum from the get-go, from preschool, and I'm not kidding. So what we need, and everybody, I don't think many people disagree with this, we need fewer standards that are higher quality, and then let teachers teach. Now, you had a favorite teacher, right?
Sure.
You maybe had several. What was it about that teacher that inspired you, that made you want to perform for him or her? And I think it's his passion for the subject. The teacher loved whatever it was he or she was talking about, right? And you wanted to do well for him or her. That was your thing. So with what's happened, apparently, with No Child Left Behind, a very reasonable idea, teachers literally don't have time to let their passion come through. They don't have time to inspire their students. And so this, I think, is a fixable problem, but it's a classic thing where you have a committee upon committee, and people have just gotten too many requirements, or there isn't time to do it, and it's not funded. Here, meet these standards, but there's no money to do it. And so it's easier to say, you know, there's a couple more things along this line. I spend a lot of time nowadays with rocket scientists.
Real rocket scientists?
Real rocket scientists. I meet, quite often, I'll meet Nobel laureates, people with Nobel Prizes. In general, these are not people you want teaching kindergarten. In general, they're just the wrong guy or gal for that. And so our problem is, although the material, if I may, the curriculum, the syllabus of kindergarten is pretty straightforward, I think, for most of us. The kind of person you want teaching that, it's a special skill. And we have to value that skill. We have to value. And everybody talks about it, but it's another thing to do it.
Bill Nye, who inspired you?
Well, it's easy to say this, but I talk about my parents. My mom was recruited to work on the Enigma code, the German code during World War II.
Really?
And, yeah, oh yeah, and she was classified for 50 years. She and her buddies would not talk about what they did. My nephew wanted to do a report about it, and they weren't allowed to talk about it. Anyway, so my dad apparently survived prison camp. He was a prisoner of war in World War II. Because he had a pretty good knowledge of the world. This is the way he would describe it. That he called himself Ned Nye, boy scientist. He was a good boy scout. He was always thinking about the world around him. And then my grandfather was an organic chemist. I was allowed to play with his glassware that he had blown himself. It was a skill that chemists had in those days. Anyway, so I was brought up with that. And then I had just some terrific teachers. I mean, Mr. Lang, my physics teacher, still teaching. The guy, I went to his class a couple years ago, and he was talking about the magnetic field around wires, and I went, this guy is so good. I will never be this good a teacher. Oh, my goodness. I just such respect for that guy. And I had Miss Rushka, my chemistry teacher. She was fantastic. I just influenced by some very good teachers. And then, as you may know, by some, I always say this, some remarkable clerical error, at Cornell University, I had Carl Sagan for astronomy.
Wow.
And this was a huge influence on me. He was, as the kids say, all that. He was all that. And this is a strange thing. You know, I'm now CEO of the Planetary Society, which was an organization started by Carl Sagan. I've been a member since it started in 1980. And I've gotten a couple emails from angry people who, for whatever reason, loved Carl Sagan, loved him, respected everything about him, or they thought they did. But they're angry with me about creationism. And maybe people have forgotten, but Carl Sagan was a huge advocate of evolution. He said on one episode of Cosmos, evolution is a fact. And it is. And evolution was discovered. It's not something people made up. And so it is an interesting irony to me the last couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. So this has bled into all different types of your work.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
I understand you're currently involved in a bit of a contest with one of your neighbors,
Ed
Begley Jr., see which of you can reduce your carbon footprint the most?
Yes, I must crush him. No, I love the guy. I mean, we literally live, everybody, four doors apart. And this is a neighborhood in Los Angeles where they shot the exteriors of Andy of Mayberry. These are old, modest houses with mature trees growing around them. Ed has 9 kilowatts of solar panels on his roof. I have 4 because my neighbor's house shades part of my roof, but I do have 4, okay?
Yeah.
And he's got, he hasn't replaced all of his windows with low emissivity double pane windows, but I have, oh yes. And he's got this low water use irrigation. So I have a low water use irrigation system, so we have fun.
Bill Nye, you will be appearing this Friday at Iowa State University.
I really am looking forward. I got to tell you, very excited.
I have here the title of your talk, You Can Change the World, 7 p.m., Stevens Auditorium, part of Iowa State Engineers Week 2012, free and open to the public. We look forward to welcoming you here in Iowa.
Good. Now, let me say, I love talking, and you may have picked up on that.
Yes.
But my favorite part of the evening are the questions and answers.
Okay.
So if you got questions, everybody, please come down. I very much look forward to it. Come on, everybody. It'll be fun.
Bill Nye, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.